This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents Babylon Rising, The Europa Conspiracy by Tim LaHaye and Bob Phillips. Read for you by Jason Cole. To all those whose study of Bible prophecy has made them anticipate the revival of the old Roman Empire, this scenario shows one possible way it could materialize in our lifetime. Chapter 1. First, there was a snapping sound, then a combination of rushing wind and sheer terror. 1,000 feet of empty space separated Murphy from the raging river and instant death. For a split second, he was suspended in midair like an eagle soaring in the sky. Then, gravity took over. Adrenaline surged through his body, and his grip tightened on the cable like a vice. Teeth clenched together, barely breathing, all he could do was to desperately hang on. As Murphy first approached the 150-foot-wide gorge, he could see two cables spanning the void attached to large trees on either side. The first cable was low to the ground, the second about 6 feet above. Hanging from the center of the top cable was what looked like a manila envelope, twisting in a gentle breeze. He shook his head. That must be the prize. As Murphy moved closer to the edge, he reached up, grabbed the top cable, and pulled hard. Very tight. Then he carefully leaned out and looked over the edge. The sight of the wild Arkansas River 1,000 feet below almost took his breath away. Do you really want to do this, Murphy? As much as you love adventure, someday Methuselah is going to get you killed. He carefully surveyed the surroundings, looking for the slightest movement. Although he could see no one, his skin began to crawl with the eerie sensation that he was being observed. He took several deep breaths, then slowly inched his way onto the cables. Holding onto the top cable with both hands and standing on the bottom cable, he bounced up and down to test their strength. As he ventured out on the cables, he realized that he had two problems, the up and down motion and the back and forth motion. The back and forth motion in particular put more weight on his hands when his feet were not directly under his body. If he had to use up his upper body strength to move the 75 feet to the center, it would be a very long way back. It didn't take him long to realize that it was not a good idea to look down at the potential 1,000-foot fall. Keep your mind on the envelope and not swinging back and forth. It took Murphy almost 15 minutes to reach the envelope. The closer he got to the center of the gorge, the more his swinging motion of the cables increased, and the more his body weight on the lower cable caused the distance between the two cables to stretch. Even though he was 6'3", his arms were now extended above his head to almost his full reach. Only 3 more feet to go, he thought reassuringly. Murphy smiled to himself as he drove into his reserved parking spot on the Preston University campus. Arriving early gave him some precious minutes alone to gather his thoughts before his classes began. A good night's sleep, great cup of coffee, and a bright, sunny morning with no clouds in the sky. It's great to be alive. The manicured lawns and lush trees made a striking contrast against the blue sky. The smell of magnolias filled the air. Murphy had grown to love the southern lifestyle. He also had grown to love his classes in biblical archaeology. In 3 years, they had become some of the most popular courses at the university. He was grateful for the opportunity he had to combine his love for archaeology with his love for the Bible. Everyone seemed to enjoy his lectures. Everyone, that is, except Dean Archer Falworth. Murphy glanced up as Sherry bounced into the office, her sparkling green eyes alive with energy. You seem pretty happy for an assistant who's late to work, Murphy teased.
I would have been here early if I didn't have to stop to pick up your mail, she replied, smiling and dropping a stack of letters, magazines, and a small box on his desk. The brown paper-wrapped box caught his attention. It bore no return address, only the name Tyler Scott. There was no sound when he shook it. Sherry was pretending to be busy, but Murphy could see her eyeing the box. It could be some unusual new artifact from a distant land. She was a dedicated archaeologist, and she was extremely curious. Because Murphy loved to tease Sherry, he set the box down, picked up his lecture notes, and started to review them.
"Aren't you going to open it?" Sherry asked.
"Open what?"
"You know exactly what. Here's some scissors."
Murphy laughed and opened the box. Sherry cocked her head, watching, as he drew out an unsigned card, which Murphy read aloud. "A gorgeous sight, a royal delight. Travel not at night, but in the daylight. He's looking for you to come. Beyond the gates, he there awaits. He's looking for you to come. For he to you, he cannot go. For him, his time is slow. He's looking for you to come. His name has been caught. It is Tyler Scott. He's looking for you to come. Use your brain. Don't be a blunderhead. The Spanish name it for the color red. He's looking for you to come."
"That's weird," Sherry said, looking puzzled. "What do you think that means?"
"I think it means trouble."
"Trouble?"
"Who else would send a strange riddle and leave it unsigned?" Sherry's look of curiosity changed to a look of anxiousness.
"Do you think it is from Methuselah?"
"Good guess, Sherry. I wonder what he is planning now."
Murphy was now close enough to reach the manila envelope twisting in the wind. His left hand bore his entire weight on the top cable as he reached out and removed the envelope with his right. He shoved the envelope down the neck of his shirt for safety, then grabbed the cable again with both hands. After a few deep breaths, he began to walk carefully back across the cables toward his starting point.
"Are you having fun, Dr. Murphy? I know I am."
Methuselah's voice boomed out, almost causing Murphy to lose his balance. Where was the sound coming from? Murphy glanced around, but over the roaring of the waters below and the blood pounding in his ears, he had no clue.
"I think that it has been too easy for you so far. Don't you think so too, Dr. Murphy?"
Murphy tried to speed up his efforts to reach the safety of the canyon wall. Methuselah's laugh echoed from the nearby rocks.
"Slow down, Murphy. There's no need to hurry."
With that, the cable under Murphy's feet gave way. Instantly, all of his weight shifted to his hands and arms as he dangled above the gorge. Working frantically, Murphy was able to swing his legs up and catch the heel of his right foot, then his left, on the upper cable. Now he was hanging above the gorge by his legs and arms.
"How long do you think you can hang on, Dr. Murphy?" Methuselah called out, cackling.
"Long enough to slide across the cable and wring your neck," Murphy cried.
Now, Doctor, you sound as if you might be upset. Let's see if we can make it a little more interesting for you."
Methuselah's cackling laugh increased, and then the upper cable snapped. Murphy could feel himself falling.
"Do you have any idea what the riddle means?" Sherry asked with a puzzled frown as she twirled one of her jet-black pigtails in her fingers.
"No, but I'm sure that it's one of his coded messages. I think we'll have to take it apart piece by piece."
"Well, he does mention he's waiting for you to come 5 different times. That must be significant."
"It must be a key thought. Let's start with the last stanza. Don't be a blunderhead. The Spanish name it for the color red."
"Could that Spanish word be the name for a state? The state of Colorado?"
"Good, Sherry. This Tyler Scott he mentioned has been caught."
"Maybe he's been caught telling a lie or caught with his hand in the cookie jar."
"Or caught being late to work for picking up some dangerous mail," Sherry grinned.
Murphy smiled.
Or maybe he's been caught by the police. Look at the phrase, his time is slow. He may be doing time in prison.
That would tie in with the gates and that he cannot go, but you must come to him. How about gorgeous sight, a royal delight? What's that all about?
Colorado, prison, gorgeous sight, a royal delight.
Murphy paced the floor, repeating those words and brushing his fingers through his hair. Then he stopped suddenly and looked at her.
I think I've got it.
Well, don't keep me in suspense. What have you got?
When I was a young boy, I visited Colorado with my parents. We flew into Denver and rented a car and spent almost a month exploring the state. On one of those trips, we went to Colorado Springs and Pikes Peak. From there, we went to a town called Pueblo. West of Pueblo is Canyon City. What do you think it is famous for?
Canyons?
Quick, Sherry. No, it's famous for the Canyon City State Penitentiary. It has a bizarre history.
Bizarre sounds like it's right up Methuselah's alley. It's his kind of place. He should live there permanently.
It was the home of the do-it-yourself hanging machine. One of the prisoners designed a self-triggering platform that would eliminate the need for a formal execution. The person who was to die would pull the lever himself. The machine operated through a series of pulleys. The pulleys would put 300 pounds of pressure on the rope. This would throw the prisoner's body upward and instantly break his neck. Everyone thought that this was an improvement over strangling slowly on the end of a rope.
Yuck, that doesn't sound like much of an improvement to me, Sherry exclaimed.
Well, the rest of the prisoners on death row didn't like it either. They then installed Colorado's first gas chamber, called Roy's Penthouse, in honor of Roy Best, the warden of the prison. Their most famous prisoner was Alfred Packer, the first Hannibal the Cannibal. He was put into prison for eating other people.
Where do you come up with these things?
Sherry knew that Murphy's mind was loaded with strange trivia. Sometimes it drove her crazy.
What does that have to do with the note?
I'm getting to that. Near Canyon City is the Royal Gorge. Get it? A gorgeous sight, a royal delight. The world's highest suspension bridge spans the gorge at the height of 1,053 feet. Feeling the bridge move on its cables and the surface shake under you as cars drive by is quite an experience. Next to the bridge is an aerial tram with one of the steepest incline railways ever built. In some places, the distance between the gorge walls narrows to only 30 feet. It's truly spectacular. They've even built an amusement park there. I'll bet you a Sanskrit manuscript that Tyler Scott is a prisoner in the Canyon City State Penitentiary. Sherry, call the prison and check if they have an inmate named Tyler Scott. Next week is spring break, and I could do with a little vacation.
Murphy heard a buzz, then the sliding sound of a metal door shutting and locking behind him. He was in a small cubicle with one wooden chair placed in front of an inch-and-a-half-thick glass window. On the wall next to the window was a phone. Murphy looked around. The drab-green paint was chipped and scratched. Names and messages were etched into the old surface. It looked as if it hadn't been painted in 20 years. After another muffled buzz, Tyler Scott entered the chamber opposite the glass window. Tall and thin, and wearing an orange prison jumpsuit, he looked to be about 27 years of age. His blonde hair was uncombed. Murphy picked up the phone.
"My name is Michael Murphy," he told Scott. "I'll get right to the point of my visit. This may sound strange, but I think you may have a message for me. Am I correct?"
"I don't get many visitors. Even my parents stopped coming about a year ago. They keep telling me that I'll never amount to anything. They say that I'm a loser."
Depression and despair had etched lines on his young face.
"I don't know what this is all about."
"Neither do I," said Murphy.
"A couple of months ago, a stranger came to visit me. He told me that a large man named Murphy would probably come and ask for a message. He left some money for me to buy magazines and cigarettes."
"What did he look like?"
"He was tall and in his mid-60s with gray hair and lots of wrinkles. He looked like he had been in the sun a lot." Oh, yeah. He walked with a slight limp. I saw it as he got up to go. His voice was different. He sort of laughed and cackled when he talked. Kind of spooky, if you ask me.
What was the message?
I'm all out of cigarettes, mister.
Murphy looked at him and smiled. I'll leave you some money for them.
Thanks. He said to go to the north side of the Royal Gorge, past the amusement park. Follow the canyon going west for 2 miles. The canyon will narrow. Look for the cables. That was it. It didn't make any sense to me.
Doesn't make any sense to me either. Thanks for your help. What are you in for?
Armed robbery. I held up a convenience store.
How much longer?
3 more years. They're teaching me auto mechanics. I hope to get a job when I get out.
I'm sure you will. Besides the money, I'll leave a book for you with the guards. I think it will help you create a new life for yourself.
On the way out, Murphy left some money and a Bible for Tyler Scott. He put a note inside suggesting that the young man start reading in the Gospel of John. As Murphy drove the 10 miles from Canyon City to the Royal Gorge, memories began to flood his mind. He remembered his father taking him on the railroad that ran at the bottom of the gorge. They had eaten lunch on the train and ridden the open-air observation cars to view the canyon from below. His highlight was going over a hanging railroad bridge with the Class 5 rapids below them.
What a great time I had with my dad. If Tyler Scott had had a caring dad, would his life be any different?
Murphy parked his car and put on his day pack as he thought about what he might be facing. He strode across the suspension bridge, proceeded west next to the gorge, leaving the amusement park and people behind him. Soon he was alone. He had forgotten how beautiful and majestic the Colorado Mountains were. Every now and then he stopped and looked into the gorge. It was quiet. All that could be heard was his boots on the ground, an occasional bird, and the sound of the rapids far below.
I need to do this more often. There's something therapeutic about being alone in God's creation.
Only one end of the top cable was attached to solid ground. Murphy was now swinging above the canyon like a human pendulum. In only moments, he would smash into the wall on the other side of the gorge. With his arms and legs clenched around the cable, Murphy prayed that he'd be able to hang on after the crash. He could make out individual rocks in the wall of stone now. Then, suddenly, the position of the cable changed. Glancing up, Murphy could see that it had struck a large rock, which broke some of the downward momentum. Murphy's impact on the wall was arms and legs first, not head first, and he was able to hold on. But panic gripped him as he swung back from the wall.
"Oh, God, I'm slipping! Help me!" he shouted.
After slipping about 20 feet, Murphy was able to stop his fall. His hands were shredded. He knew there was no way he could climb out of the canyon. The top looked to be 100 feet away. His only hope for survival was to shinny up the cable to the rock outcropping above him, quickly, before his strength faded. Murphy was almost exhausted by the time he reached the rock outcropping and pulled himself to safety. He lay there for some time, breathing deeply. When his breathing returned to normal, he checked out his surroundings. He was on a flat rock shelf about 5 feet wide and 4 feet long. The rest of the outcropping was too steep to stand on. He dragged the cable up and hooked it around a rock. He didn't want to lose his only connection with the top of the gorge. His bloody hands were shaking violently as he took off his day pack and took out a couple of energy bars and a bottle of water.
"Okay, Murphy, you're alive. Calm down."
He could barely unscrew the lid of the water bottle.
"I'm getting too old for this. If I could get my hands on Methuselah, I'd kill him. Well, at least beat him till he's almost dead and stop his crazy cackling."
Murphy knew he had to regain his strength to be able to climb to the top of the canyon. After eating the energy bars and drinking the water, he put the pack under his head and lay down to sleep for a little while.
"God, thank you for sparing my life. Please give me the strength and courage to climb out of here."
It was the cry of a hawk gliding gently through the canyon that woke Murphy. Sitting up, he tried to assess his situation. His eyes followed the cable to where he could see the edge of the gorge and safety far above him. He knew he couldn't climb that far on a steel cable. Neither could he stay on this ledge at Methuselah's mercy. He did have a few resources, though. He took off his belt and made it into a prussic knot with a loop for his hand to fit into. From the shoulder straps of his day pack, he formed two more prussic knots and loops to stand in. After he wove the knots into the cable, steeling himself for what he was about to do, he began the long, slow climb to the top of the gorge. Murphy hung his body weight on his right hand, which was hooked through the loop. He then reached down with his left hand and slid up the prussic knots that were attached to his feet. Then he stood up on the loops and slid the belt up the cable. He continued this process like an inchworm climbing a branch. It took almost an hour and a half for him to work his way to the top. By the time Murphy pulled himself over the top of the canyon wall and uttered a prayer of thanks, Methuselah was nowhere to be seen or heard. Perhaps he assumed that Murphy would never make it out alive, or, more likely, he just got bored.
"There must not have been enough excitement for him," Murphy thought dryly.
As he looked around, he saw something at the base of the tree where the cables had been attached. Sitting on a rock was a brass balancing scale. Broken wooden numbers lay in the two pans of the scale. The numbers 1 and 2 had been snapped in half. Part of each one lay in each pan. A 3x5 card was under the scale. Murphy picked it up and read the words.
"Babylon, 375 meters directly northeast of the head."
Murphy shook his head.
"Methuselah, you're not through with the games yet, are you? Well, at least you had faith in me to live through your stupid tricks."
Murphy had almost forgotten about the manila envelope in his shirt. Now he pulled it out and opened it carefully. He peered in but couldn't determine what was inside, so he tipped the envelope and poured the contents into his hand.
Plaster.
Chapter 2. The town of Akkad, 23 miles from Babylon, 539 B.C. Dark figures crept stealthily through the sleeping town. Some moved in pairs, but most were alone. Each, however, was fully aware of the danger. At every turn of the streets, they glanced around nervously to see if they were being followed. If discovered, they were sure to be beheaded. Yet anger and greed overcame their fear of death and drove them to the meeting. It was cold and late at night. The quarter moon and cloud-filled sky created deep shadows. It was the perfect cover they needed. Only an occasional barking dog could be heard. There were no welcoming lights in the darkened building they approached. After a coded knock, the door opened, and they were ushered into a large room lighted with just a few small flickering oil lamps. Smells of garlic, curry, and body odor permeated the air. Bearded men with nervous dark eyes were seated on oriental rugs, the flickering light casting eerie shadows on their faces and brightly colored turbans. Some whispered angrily to each other. Others were quiet. Most looked very anxious and apprehensive. The satrap from the province of Susa, Abd al-Rashid, a squat man with bad breath, was the last to enter. Governor Abu Bakr and Governor Husam al-Din nodded as he strode in. Everyone looked toward the two governors. Husam al-Din was the first to speak.
"We have sources close to King Darius who inform us that he is planning to promote the old Hebrew as his chief administrative officer. We cannot let this happen. If he is placed in charge over us, it will affect our entire operation."
Abu Bakr added,
"He is not a man who can be bribed or corrupted. He is too honest. Others have tried and have lost their lives as a result. We must come up with a plan to discredit him to King Darius."
Those opening words caused a soft murmur. Kadar al-Karim raised his hand.
The old Hebrew is faithful to Darius. It is doubtful that we will be able to accuse him of disloyalty. But there may be a way, however. The old man is a follower of Jehovah. His dedicated religious faith can be twisted and used against him. We must convince the king that the old man's god is in some way against Darius.
Daniel was finishing his meal of fruit and bread when his aide came into the room.
Master, King Darius has sent a messenger with a command. He has asked that you and the other two governors and his 120 satraps meet in the royal palace in 4 days from today.
Did the messenger say what the meeting was about?
No, he only mentioned that Darius was going to create a new law. It will be an irrevocable law of the Medes and Persians.
Daniel slowly shook his head.
I hope that he will think through the new law carefully. In my 85 years, I have seen many kings regret passing a law they cannot change.
At the sound of the trumpet, the crowd grew silent. People turned toward the door, clapping as Daniel entered. Daniel smiled and nodded at the men in multicolored robes as he walked toward his place near the king's throne. He knew in his heart that it was all an act. Although the men in the room were smiling and applauding, he could sense their hatred and jealousy. He had discovered their secret system of corruption. They knew he could expose them at any moment. He was fully aware that these hypocrites were his political enemies. The royal guard began to file into the large hall from behind the throne. Soon, many trumpets began to sound, and everyone rose in silence. Loud cheers and applause broke forth when King Darius entered, smiling and waving. His gold-embroidered scarlet and blue robes barely covered his short, portly body. After what seemed to be an eternity, Darius finally sat down and lowered his scepter.
I have been informed that all of you have held a meeting and unanimously came up with a wonderful suggestion, he stated.
What? Daniel had not been part of any meeting. He knew something was wrong. Smiling broadly, Darius continued.
I appreciate your loyalty and your desire to honor me as your king. Because of that, I'm going to issue a new law that will be in effect for the next 30 days. It will be an unalterable law of the Medes and Persians. It will not be annulled for any reason. For the next 30 days, anyone who prays to any god or man except me will be thrown into the den of lions.
Then Daniel quickly understood their plan. Darius called for the scribes and signed the decree to the cheers of the audience, except for one man. The lion collapsed with a roar as Daniel fell onto its back. It took a moment or two for Daniel to catch his breath. After he had gathered his wits, he tried to focus. The only light entering the den came from the hole in the ceiling through which he had just been thrown. The smell of the lions and their droppings was almost overpowering. It made it hard to breathe. As he looked around, he could see the slanted yellow eyes of many surprised cats looking at him. One of the large males began to roar, soon followed by others. The sound was deafening and terrifying. Daniel could feel fear surging through his body. He had seen lions before, but only caged. Now there were no bars, only about 30 lions milling about him just a few feet away.
Dear God, I have faithfully served you. Please give me strength to face death today.
Daniel's prayer was interrupted by a voice from above, Darius. Daniel could hear the torment in the king's voice.
Daniel, my heart is in anguish. I tried to save you, but I could not. May your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you. Goodbye, my faithful servant.
Before he could respond, he heard another sound. The scraping of the large stone that covered the hole into which he had been thrown. The royal guard was shoving it back into place.
Scribes soon brought melted wax and poured it on one end of the stone. As the wax rolled down off the rock and onto the ground, it formed a puddle. As the wax was drying, Darius and some of his nobles took their rings and made impressions, signifying the unalterable law of the Medes and Persians. Anyone who broke the seal and tried to rescue Daniel would be put to death immediately. With the rock covering the hole, only small shafts of light entered the den. Daniel could hear the lions moving about him. Occasionally, one startled him with a roar. When would the attack begin? For about 15 minutes, he sat in the middle of the den with his arms wrapped around his knees, nervously rocking back and forth and praying. His heart leaped to his throat when the tail of a lion hit him in the face as the large creature walked by. Half an hour passed before Daniel realized that perhaps the lions were not going to attack him. Slowly he began to move. As he made his way toward a wall, he could feel bones under his feet, human bones. The thought made him want to throw up. Finally, he reached the wall and leaned his back against it and listened. He could hear the lions moving around in the darkness. Occasionally, he felt a lion's breath and whiskers on his face as it sniffed him. It was an extremely unnerving experience. He kept anticipating that sharp teeth and pain would follow the warm breath. Daniel thought back to how he had felt when he first heard Darius's most recent decree. He knew that the satraps and governors had set a trap just for him, because they and he knew that he would not be able to pray to Darius. Jehovah was the only true God of heaven and earth. No one else deserved worship, especially not some small, overweight man with a large ego and an abundance of pride and arrogance. He recalled how the delegation of satraps had broken into his room while he was praying. They had grabbed him and brought him to Darius, telling the king that Daniel was praying to Jehovah and asking for his help. The color had drained from Darius's face when he realized that he had sentenced his most faithful leader to death. The king had spent the day in frantic attempts to save Daniel, but finally Darius acknowledged that he could find no way to rescind his original ruling. Eventually, Daniel began to drift off, his thoughts turning to the first time he had come to Babylon. Chapter 3.
It seems to me I recall someone talking to me last week about being late to work.
Sherry, dressed in her usual white lab coat, didn't even look up from her microscope when Murphy entered the lab. He knew she was pretending not to smile.
"I'm glad to see that your powers of observation are improving," he answered.
She looked up with a smile.
"Say, what's with the scratch on your head?" she asked, concerned.
"Was spring break too hard on you?"
"A rock attacked me."
"Right. It just leaped off the ground and rushed at you."
"Well, actually, more like I rushed at it."
Sherry looked at him more closely.
"How about the scabs on your knuckles? Did you have a boxing match with the rock, too?"
"You could say that."
Her good-natured jesting suddenly turned serious.
"This doesn't have anything to do with Methuselah, does it?"
Her words sounded just like something Laura would say. Ever since Laura had died, Sherry had taken over the job of worrying about him. Murphy changed the subject. He didn't want to explain his near-death experience. He didn't want her to start saying that he should stay away from Methuselah.
"I've got something for you to look at," he said, handing her a manila envelope.
Sherry's curiosity was piqued. She knew that Murphy didn't want to talk about what had happened, so she turned the envelope over in her hands and asked,
"What's in it?"
"A little surprise. I want you to tell me what you think."
She poured the contents of the envelope onto a sheet of paper on the work table. Murphy's encounter with the wall had crushed the plaster.
As she looked closely at it, she said, "Oh, by the way, Bob Wagoner called before you came in late for work. He said he'd like you to give him a call."
Murphy smiled as he walked to his office. Chapter 4. Bob waved to Murphy from his usual booth in the back. Murphy smiled and nodded, thinking, "We're all creatures of habit." They shook hands, and Murphy slid across the green vinyl bench and sat down. The decor of Adam's Apple Diner hadn't changed since it had opened in the late 1970s, and Roseanne, the gray-haired waitress, looked like she had worked there and eaten lots of food there since its beginning.
"What's on the menu today?" Bob asked as she approached the table.
"There's lots on the menu, Pastor Bob, but my guess is that you'll have your usual cheeseburger and chili fries."
"You've got me pegged, Roseanne."
He threw up his arms in mock surrender.
"And for you, Dr. Murphy, the chicken sandwich?"
"You're a mind reader, Roseanne."
"I'll get your coffee,"
she said as she waddled off toward the kitchen.
"Well, bring me up to date, Michael. We really haven't had a chance to talk since you got back from your trip to Ararat. Were you able to find the Ark?"
Murphy's big smile left his face. Wagoner could sense uneasiness and pain.
"Did something go wrong?"
he asked, his voice turning somber. For the next 40 minutes, Murphy recounted the deaths of his climbing party. He shared the betrayal of Colonel Blake Hodson and Larry Whittaker, the photographer, and how they had killed Professor Reinhold, Mustafa Bayer, Darren Lundquist, and Salvador Valdez, the former Navy SEAL. He then went on to describe how Talon had tried to kill him, and how Asgardian had rescued him. Wagoner listened quietly as he ate his cheeseburger. Not only was he absolutely spellbound by the tragic story, but he knew that Murphy needed to talk. Holding that much pain inside was not healthy.
"How about Vern Peterson, the helicopter pilot? What happened to him?" Wagoner asked when Murphy paused.
"He instinctively knew that something was desperately wrong. He saw the control box in Whittaker's hand and tried to descend away from the radio signals before the bomb blast. He realized that he couldn't escape and leaped out of the helicopter in desperation."
"It's a wonder that he wasn't killed."
"Well, his fall was broken by a huge snowbank. It softened his landing somewhat, and the snow covered him at the moment of the explosion. When I saw him, he was in the cave with me, Isis, and Asgardian. The guardian of the Ark not only rescued me, but he brought Peterson to safety."
"Was Vern all right after the drop from the helicopter?"
"At first, we thought he only had some bad cuts and a sprained ankle, but he was coughing a lot in the cave, and we realized that he must have some internal bleeding. We got him to a small clinic in Dogubayazit. From there, he was transferred to the hospital in Erzurum. He's recovering now in Turkey and should be back in the U.S. sometime this month."
"And the Ark? Did you find it?"
Murphy was quiet for a while, then looked around the diner as if checking whether anyone was listening. He leaned toward Wagoner and replied,
"It was unbelievable. Fantastic. It was better than anything I could have ever imagined."
Wagoner's eyes grew wide.
"You got to be kidding," he exclaimed. "You really found it?"
"Yes, Bob. It was there. Half of it was buried in a glacier, but we were able to enter the rest of it."
"Did you bring back some pictures?"
Murphy's eyes lost their sparkle.
"Talon destroyed them all. We have no physical evidence. Talon set a charge and started an avalanche that covered the Ark with tons of snow. There are now only 4 living eyewitnesses, myself, Isis, Asgardian, and Talon. It would take a miracle to find the Ark now."
Wagoner saw the disappointment on Murphy's face. He decided to change the course of the conversation.
"Speaking of Isis, how's she doing?" he asked, smiling slightly.
Murphy smiled back. "She's doing fine. She went back to work at the Parchments of Freedom Foundation. I think she was a little tired after all the trials we went through."
"That's not exactly what I was talking about."
Murphy smiled again. "She's a very attractive woman, Bob."
"Are you interested?"
"Okay, I'm interested, but I feel a little guilty."
"Michael, it's been a year and a half since Laura's death. Stop beating yourself up. Let me ask you a question. What do you think Laura would want you to do? Do you think she would want you to remain single forever?"
"Okay, Bob, I've got your message. Could we change the subject?"
"Did you find anything on the Ark?" Wagoner asked.
He could sense the excitement on his friend's face.
Well, come on, man. I'm dying to know.
I must have your word that you won't repeat what I'm going to tell you.
You got it, Michael. I'll not say a word.
Murphy proceeded to tell him about the discovery of the brass plates that held the secret of the Philosopher's Stone, a discovery that could eliminate the need for fossil fuels. He talked about the singing sword they found, and the vases full of self-lighting crystals. Wagner sat there, nodding in amazement.
Where are the brass plates, sword, and crystals now?
At the bottom of the Black Sea, with Talon. I think he was chewed to pieces by the propeller blades of the ship, which made me feel sorry for the ship.
Wagner made a face.
I can't blame you for having such feelings.
He would probably feel the same way if someone had crushed his wife's larynx.
Is there any way to retrieve the plates?
There might be if we had a mini-sub and lots of time. However, it'd be like looking for a needle in a haystack.
Doesn't that ship travel the same route each week?
I'm sure it does, Murphy replied. Why?
Couldn't you get the charts of their route? If you had that and the approximate time of day when Talon went overboard, you could narrow the search quite a bit. At least it would be a smaller haystack.
That's not a bad idea, Bob. And if we had some metal detecting equipment, it might be possible. I don't think the pack has had much time to settle into the sand yet. It might be worth a try.
Murphy glanced at his watch. Time had flown by.
Hey, Bob, I've got to go.
The two men walked out to the parking lot. Wagner said,
I'd like to pray with you before I leave. I want to pray that God will give you great wisdom and courage. He has evidently called you to some very unique and dangerous tasks. I'm also going to pray about your possible relationship with Isis.
Thanks, Bob. I appreciate your friendship, and I can certainly use your prayers.
Chapter 5.
Well, Stephanie Kovacs, ace reporter, are you happy?
She could see the emptiness in her eyes as she looked in the mirror to put on her lipstick.
Do you like being a mistress? Is it worth the price?
Now she found herself getting angry. She had sold her own pride and self-image for an extravagant lifestyle, for power and influence, and to further her career as a news journalist. She stood up and shook her head a little. It gave her hair that wild tiger look that Shane liked. She took one last look at her low-cut black dress that gave maximum exposure to her ample chest. She felt sexy. She smoothed the dress over her slim hips and turned and looked at herself from both sides. Pleased, she left the room. Barrington was pacing back and forth in front of the penthouse windows when she entered the living room. Behind him, the lights of the city sparkled like beautiful jewels in the night.
"What's wrong, Shane?" Stephanie asked.
He looked a little startled and slightly embarrassed. Shane Barrington was not the kind of man who liked anyone to think that he could be bothered by anything. Frowning, he said,
"I was just thinking about something."
"Between us?"
There was a touch of fear in her voice. Even though they had been together for a while, she didn't feel secure in their relationship. Barrington was known for his verbal bursts of anger and had blown up at her on several occasions. He had never hit her, but often she felt that she had to walk on eggshells around him.
"No, no, of course not. I was just thinking about work. We haven't had a good news story in a couple of weeks. I like to be on top of any breaking events. It's good for the ratings and makes the Barrington Network News lots of money."
Kovacs nodded.
"Say, whatever happened to Professor What's-His-Name at Preston University? You know, the one who searches for biblical artifacts?" Barrington asked.
"You mean Dr. Michael Murphy?"
Yeah, that's the one. Didn't he leave on some kind of search for something?"
Barrington knew full well who Murphy was. He was just trying to play dumb. He didn't want to come across as too interested. That would arouse Stephanie's news reporter curiosity. He also didn't want to reveal the increased pressure that the Seven were putting on him for information. They hadn't heard from Talon after he had come down from Ararat. He had seemed to disappear off the face of the earth. Immediately, a red flag went up in Kovacs's mind.
"What's Shane trying to do?" she wondered. "He knows full well who Murphy is and that he's looking for Noah's Ark. He even tried to hire him, but Murphy turned him down. Who's he trying to fool?"
"Yes," Kovacs replied slowly, thinking. "He was looking for Noah's Ark on Mount Ararat."
Whatever came of that, Barrington, looking out the windows, appeared to be engrossed in a police helicopter flying with its searchlight on.
"I don't know. He's after something."
A spark of enthusiasm surged through her. It reminded her of the excitement she felt when following up on investigative leads. Maybe this was the opportunity she had been looking for. Her mind flashed back to that night when she stepped into the room on top of the Barrington Communications building. It had been filled with huge sprays of flowers, the carpet sprinkled with rose petals. Barrington had said that it was in appreciation for her hard work and loyalty, and that it was to make up for having missed dinner with her. That night, a small crack in his armor of secrecy had been exposed. He had told her that some people had found out about his massive debts and less-than-legal creative accounting. They had invested $5 billion into Barrington Communications, and he was now their pawn. Kovacs had wondered who these powerful people were, but Barrington would say only that they were hell-bent on establishing a one-world government, and a one-world religion, too. And people like Murphy, they see it all coming in the Bible, so they have to be stopped before they can persuade others to resist. In the time that they had been together, Kovacs had recognized that Barrington was doing something more than just making money. It was more than just fulfilling a power-hungry ego. It was something evil. "I need to get away from this man and his lifestyle," Stephanie recognized. "It's not what I really want. It's empty. Maybe this is where I can make some kind of difference and somehow redeem my poor choices. I can warn Murphy of the danger he is in."
"Shane, why don't you let me check it out for you? There might be a story that you could use."
"Perfect. She took the bait," Barrington grinned to himself. "She's so easy to manipulate." "Well, that might give you a change of pace," he said. "If that's something you'd like to do, then go for it. Take one of the cameramen if you need one. You can also use the jet if you like."
"You can't let Shane know your true feelings. You need more time to plan your escape from him. You must keep up the masquerade."
Kovacs ran over to him and gave him a big hug. He kissed her.
"Great. I'll have a good evening tonight and get the information I need, too. Not bad, Barrington. Not bad."
Chapter 6
"Murphy, do you have any idea how old that white powder and chips were?"
Sherry's green eyes were bright with excitement. She so loved the joy of discovery.
"Let me guess, Sherry. At least 2,000 years old?"
Sherry put her hands on her hips and cocked her head.
"You knew, didn't you?" she said accusingly.
"I was only guessing, Sherry."
Murphy proceeded to tell her about his vacation in Colorado. When he was finished, she began, Murphy put his hand up to stop her.
I know, you're going to tell me I shouldn't have gone."
"You got that right."
She knew that it would be a losing battle to go any further.
"Well, after all that effort, did you come to any conclusion?" she asked.
"I have to admit it took me quite a while. The brass scale at the base of the tree was quite a puzzler, especially with the broken numbers 1 and 2.
"Did the note help?"
"In fact, it did. I kept repeating the phrase over and over in my mind. Babylon, 375 meters directly northeast of the head. Then it hit me. It was referring to the head of the golden statue that Nebuchadnezzar built, the same one that was taken to the Parchments of Freedom Foundation. Methuselah was giving me directions to another find. It must be located 375 meters directly northeast of where we found the golden head."
"What do you think it is?"
"Hold on to your pigtails. I think you're going to like this. I think it might be the handwriting on the wall that was mentioned in Daniel chapter 5.
You mean the one where God used the fingers and hand of a man to write a message to King Belshazzar? You're crazy. How'd you come up with that?
It was the scale with the broken numbers, 1 and 2, in the pans. Remember what the handwriting on the wall said?
No, I don't.
It said, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin.
Oh, that's right. How could I forget? That makes perfect sense. I really understand now.
Okay, okay, give me a break. The word Mene means numbered. It was repeated twice. That stands for the numbers 1 and 2 in the pans. The word Tekel means weighed. That's what the brass scales represented. The word Upharsin means divided. That's why the numbers were divided into two pieces. Translated into plain English, it means God numbered the days of Belshazzar's rule as the king. He found him weighed in the balance scales of God's judgment, and he was to be punished by dividing his kingdom and giving it to others.
What about the white powder?
It's plaster. In Daniel chapter 5, it says that the handwriting was in the plaster on the wall opposite the lampstand. I believe that the envelope held some of the plaster off that very wall. If this theory is true, that plaster is over 2,500 years old.
Murphy went to his office and phoned the Parchments of Freedom Foundation for ISIS. He didn't realize how nervous he was until he was placed on hold. Drumming his fingers on the desk, he thought,
"You're like a schoolboy, Murphy. Grow up."
"Michael."
Murphy could hear the excitement in Isis's voice. He smiled, wishing he could drown in her sparkling green eyes.
"Pull yourself together."
"Isis, how are you?"
There was a slight pause.
"I'm better now, Michael."
For a moment, her words caught him off guard. He wasn't usually tongue-tied, but now he struggled to collect his thoughts.
"Isis, I'm in between classes now. I was thinking about you and was wondering if..."
"Okay, you can do this."
"You might be free Friday and Saturday. I need to fly up to New York. Could you fly up from D.C. and meet me for the weekend?"
"That sounds wonderful, Michael."
After hanging up, Isis let out a big breath of air and stared out the window. Just hearing his voice had sent a thrill through her.
Chapter 7.
Murphy could feel his Irish temper rising. The closer he got to the lecture hall, the more irritated he was becoming. It had all started when he pulled up in the parking lot and saw the van with BNN on the side. The thought of Barrington Network News being on campus brought a bad taste to his mouth. His mind flashed back to the explosion at the church. He remembered trying to comfort Sherry over the loss of her brother, and Pastor Bob trying to console him over the murder of Laura. A BNN crew had been there. The network seemed always to be butting in at the most inopportune and painful times in a person's life. All the reporters wanted was a big story. They didn't care about people's feelings. Then his thoughts shifted to the funeral of Hank Baines. He could remember what that reporter, Stephanie Kovacs, had said as she shoved a microphone in front of his face. "Here at the memorial service for FBI agent Hank Baines, I'm talking with Dr. Michael Murphy of Preston University. Dr. Murphy, you were the last person to see Hank Baines alive, is that right?" She had tried to pressure him into an emotional response. "What is it you and Agent Baines were discussing, Dr. Murphy? Have you told the police? Have you told his grieving widow? Tell me, do you feel any sense of responsibility for his death?"
Since that time, Murphy's resentment of news reporters had grown.
Near the entrance to the lecture hall, he could see Stephanie Kovacs sitting on a bench under the magnolia tree. Students were talking with her. Her cameraman was positioning himself for the best shots. She rose as he approached.
"Dr. Murphy, could I have a moment with you?"
Students were watching, so Murphy did his best to appear cordial. He took a deep breath and said,
"What can I do for you, Miss Kovacs?"
"We happen to be in the area and were wondering if it would be possible for us to attend your lecture today."
"Right, just happen to be in the area."
Murphy had suspicions that there was more she was after, but all he said was,
"Anyone is free to come in, Miss Kovacs."
"Would it be permissible to shoot some video footage?" She flashed her most charming smile.
"I suppose, as long as you don't disturb the class. I prefer to have the students thinking about the topic rather than what they'll look like on the evening news."
"Thank you, Dr. Murphy. We will be quite discreet."
"Quite discreet. Now there's a change. What's with this meek and mild approach?" "Good morning, class. Before we get started today, you may have noticed that we have a celebrity with us, Stephanie Kovacs. Most of you will recognize her as one of BNN's top investigative reporters. She's brought along her cameraman." The rowdy students clapped, cheered, and whistled. Kovacs acknowledged the din with a smile. "The cameraman will be moving around, taking a few shots. Try not to make faces or hand signs, or you may be investigated," Murphy warned with a grin. Everyone laughed. "That especially goes for you, Clayton." Clayton Anderson, the class clown, turned his palms up and opened his mouth in mock shock.
"Who, me?" he mouthed, pointing at himself.
"Today, we will be considering a new subject," Murphy said more seriously. "We'll focus on the ancient city of Babylon. You may want to jot down a few notes. This will be on the test." There was a groan and the sound of notebooks opening. As you will recall from the lectures about Noah's Ark, Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham was the son who violated his father while he was asleep. One of his sons was named Cush, and he had a son named Nimrod. Murphy could see that some of the students had a questioning look on their faces. "Stay with me. I need to lay this foundation. In plain English, Nimrod was the great-grandson of Noah. The Bible calls him a great hunter or warrior. His name in Hebrew literally means, 'Let us rebel.' This can all be found in Genesis chapter 10. The Jewish historian Josephus identifies Nimrod as the builder of the Tower of Babel. This great tower was built to represent the people's rebellion to God and the setting up of their own power structure. They did not want to come under his influence. It was at the Tower of Babel that God confused the people and created different language groups."
"Dr. Murphy," Clayton called, raising his hand, "I thought that the Tower of Babel was where King Solomon kept all of his wives."
The class broke out in laughter. "I'm glad you feel better now, Clayton. May we continue?" Murphy said with a wry smile. The cameraman was videotaping the entire interaction. "Nimrod was the founder of Babylon along with a number of other cities. He was also the founder of Baal worship, the world's first organized system of idolatry. The city became famous many years later because of a great king named Nebuchadnezzar, who broke the power of Egypt at the Battle of Carchemish and ruled Babylon for 45 years. Murphy dimmed the lights and turned on the PowerPoint projector. Up came an artist's recreation of the city of Babylon. "Babylon is located about 50 miles south of Baghdad. Have any of you heard about this town in the news lately? Babylon lay on a great plain with a large man-made lake above the city. At the height of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, the gardens of the city were considered one of the wonders of the world. Herodotus estimated that the great wall that circled the city was 60 miles long, encompassing almost 200 square miles. Some of the walls were 80 feet thick, and many chariots could ride abreast on top of the wall. 250 towers were on the wall. It was estimated that 500,000 people lived within the city walls, and another 700,000 people in the extended city outside of the walls." Murphy clicked up another slide. "Most of the city was made of sun-dried bricks, and most of the bricks carried this inscription: 'Nebuchadnezzar, son of Nabopolassar, king of Babylon.' I know you're disappointed they didn't have your name on them, Clayton. They would have said 'King of Jokes.'" Everyone laughed and whistled. Murphy clicked up a slide of an ancient temple. "There were 53 temples within the city. The structures were called ziggurats. They consisted of 3 to 7 platforms that grew smaller as they rose in height. The next slide will give you some idea of the size of a ziggurat. After clicking up another slide, Murphy paused so the students could absorb the information. At their murmurs,